Our first reading is from Psalm 6, which should be on page 529 of the Brown Pew Bibles. I'll give you a wee moment to find that. Psalm 6. O Lord, do not rebuke me in your anger or discipline me in your wrath. Be merciful to me, Lord, for I am faint. O Lord, heal me, for my bones are in agony. My soul is in anguish. How long, O Lord, how long? Turn, O Lord, and deliver me. Save me because of your unfailing love. No one remembers you when he is dead. Who praises you from the grave? I am worn out from groaning. All night long I flood my bed with weeping and drench my couch with tears. My eyes grow weak with sorrow. They fail because of all my foes. Away from me, all you who do evil. For the Lord has heard my weeping. The Lord has heard my cry for mercy. The Lord accepts my prayer. All my enemies will be ashamed and dismayed. They will turn back in sudden disgrace. This is the word of the Lord.
Thanks be to God.
Morning. The second reading is from Matthew, chapter 25, verses 14 to 30. On page 961. So that's Matthew 25, starting at verse 14. Again, it will be like a man going on a journey who called his servants and entrusted his property to them. To one he gave 5 talents of money, to another 2 talents, and to another 1 talent, each according to his ability. Then he went on his journey. The man who received the 5 talents went at once and put his money to work and gained 5 more. So also the one with 2 talents gained 2 more. But the man who had received the 1 talent went off, dug a hole in the ground, and hid his master's money. After a long time, the master of those servants returned and settled accounts with them. The man who had received the 5 talents brought another 5. Master, he said, you entrusted me with 5 talents. See, I have gained 5 more. His master replied, well done, good and faithful servant. You have been faithful with a few things. I will put you in charge of many things. Come and share your master's happiness. The man with 2 talents also came. Master, he said, you entrusted me with 2 talents. See, I have gained 2 more. His master replied, well done, good and faithful servant. You have been faithful with a few things. I will put you in charge of many things. Come and share your master's happiness. Then the man who had received the 1 talent came. Master, he said, I knew that you were a hard man, harvesting where you had not sown and gathering where you had not scattered seed. So I was afraid and went out and hid your talent in the ground. See, here is what belongs to you. His master replied, you wicked, lazy servant. So you knew that I harvest where I had not sown and gather where I had not scattered seed? Well then, you should have put my money on deposit with the bankers, so that when I returned, I would have received it back with interest. Take the talent from him and give it to the one who has 10 talents. For everyone who has will be given more, and he will have an abundance. Whoever does not have, even what he has, will be taken from him. And throw that worthless servant outside into darkness, where there will be weeping and gnashing of teeth. This is the word of the Lord.
In May 1942, General Douglas MacArthur, commander of the Allied forces in the Pacific, was forced to surrender the Philippines to the Japanese. But before the Americans departed, he had a mass of photos printed of himself with the words underneath, I will return, and distributed across the islands. He was true to his promise. At the end of 1944, he did return, and they retook those islands. Well, today we're looking at the return of the Lord Jesus Christ. We're in the season of the church called Advent. Advent meaning coming. And thinking not just about the first coming of Jesus, the first Christmas, but also his second coming, that he's using the season of Advent to prepare for his return. And many times, of course, Jesus spoke about the day of his return. In fact, in the parable before this one, the parable of the 10 virgins, the point of the parable was to encourage the disciples to watch and be ready. And this parable goes on to teach how to be ready. And the way to be ready on the day when Jesus Christ returns is to work between now and then. The first parable says watch. The second parable says work. For real faith, the kind of faith is the kind of faith that shows itself in how we live in these in-between times. We are effectively in enemy-occupied territory. There's that extraordinary verse in, I think it's 1 John, that says the whole world is under the control of the evil one. And one day our great liberator, Jesus Christ, will return. And how we live in the ups and downs of life between now and that day will be the evidence for whether our faith was a living faith or only a dead one. So let's look at this together. The story itself is fairly simple. There's a man, we're told, who was going on a journey, who called his servants and entrusted his property to them. Given what Jesus has just been saying about his imminent return, the man in view is clearly Jesus himself. And he is on a journey. He ascended from this world to his Father in heaven, and one day he will come back. To some people, of course, this is absolutely fanciful. What? You believe that? In the year 2020? Really? Perhaps it conjures up an image of a man on a street corner with a sandwich board saying that the world is nigh, the end is nigh. It just seems so improbable to many people. How could they even begin to know whether this is true? But we need to recognize the Bible consistently teaches this. It's not a minor theme or something based on a single verse. It's the widespread teaching of the Bible, and indeed was taught many times by Jesus himself, and is a promise that is itself backed up by the incarnation, when God came to earth as Jesus that first Christmas time. For if Jesus can come into this world once through the greatest miracle in the Bible, the virgin birth, it's hardly stretching the bounds of belief to think he could return. And in between his first and second comings, he calls his servants and hands over the running of his financial affairs to them. And that brings us to the first main point in this parable, which is the master entrusted his servants with varying responsibilities. It's rather striking, I think, that the people in the parable are called servants. That reminds us straight away that we are all servants in this world. We are born into this world as servants, servants of the devil, and through faith in Christ, we are set free from that kind of slavery, and we become willing servants of Christ. And so every person in the world is either a slave to the devil or a slave to Christ. Now, to each of these servants, he gives an amount of money, 5 talents to one, 2 talents to one, and 1 talent to the third. We don't know how much a talent was, but it seems to have been a very considerable sum of money. We don't know exactly, but we should think perhaps in terms of a six-figure sum in today's currency. I mean, it really was that amount. So that's a difference to Luke 19, where there's a very similar parable to this, and the parable of the 10 minas, and that's a much smaller amount. This is much, much bigger. There's another difference as well, which is in this parable, we're told that they're given the amount according to their ability. You see that in verse 15. To one he gave 5 talents of money, to another 2 talents, to another 1 talent, each according to his ability. In the parable in Luke chapter 19, they are all in the same situation. They're all the same type of people, but they're rewarded differently. Here, it's the difference between the people themselves, between the servants, which is emphasized. They are given different amounts to work with according to their ability. And that's very instructive for us because it teaches us that we should not be comparing ourselves to other people here. The basic point is that there are differences between people, and God entrusts people with different amounts according to those differences. I mean, we all have different backgrounds. We have different family backgrounds. We were raised in different ways, which will have lifelong effects on us. We have different educational backgrounds. We have different spiritual backgrounds, along with them different spiritual privileges. We have different energy levels. We have different personalities. We have different pressures upon us in life. We have different strengths. And so we shouldn't be comparing ourselves one with another. It can be tempting in the Christian life to look at someone else and think, well, I mean, that's incredible. I could never do what they do. I mean, just look at them go. And we feel rather inadequate. Or perhaps for a different kind of person, they might look down on someone else and think, well, why does this other person do a bit more in the Christian life? I don't understand why they sit around so much. Now, here the point is that God has made us all different. There is no one else in this world like you. You are a unique person. And that forces each of us to ask the same question of ourselves. Am I faithful? Am I faithful using what God has given me as the person that I am in the situation in which he has put me? Am I faithful in my situation? Not am I faithful in someone else's situation, or would they be faithful in my situation? In other words, we shouldn't justify our laziness, for example, by our own sense of worthlessness, as if there's nothing we can really contribute because everyone else seems to be so good at what they do. That's not the way we should think. We shouldn't justify our lack of contribution by personal busyness. Well, it's so much easier for other people. They seem to have a bit less on, but, you know, I mean, I'm just so busy in life and my work and everything. Well, no, these are choices. We are responsible for whether we are faithful in the situation we are at. And we certainly shouldn't justify our self-righteous pride looking down on someone else who frankly has a much tougher life than us in every direction, who knows the difficulties and the stresses and the pressures that someone else feels in life, someone else has to contend with in life. So we're not supposed to be comparing our Christian service with that of other people. God will assess us for the people that we are, not for the people that they are. So the question is for each of us, what can you, as the person God has made you to be, with the personality and the strengths and the background and the frailties that you have, what can you do in service of the Master? As an aside, I don't think we should necessarily be equating talents specifically with spiritual gifts, so much as seeing them as representative of everything God gives us, which enables us to serve him. The truth is that God gives everything to us that we enjoy in life, whether it's time or energy or health or opportunities or gifts or the people around us, all of which together contribute to the possibility of us serving him. So the question is, with the whole package that we have and the whole package that you are, what can you do to serve the Master before he returns? That's the question for us to wrestle with this morning. And that leads us on to the sort of the heart of the story, where we see that the Master rewarded his productive servants for their faithfulness. The Master rewarded his productive servants for their faithfulness. Okay, so the Master goes away, goes on his journey, and the servants get to work. And the one who received 5 talents, verse 16, put his money to work and gained 5 more. The one with the 2 talents gained 2 more. And then this one who has 1 talent goes off, digs a hole in the ground, and hides his master's money. And then comes the day of reckoning. For after this period of time, we don't know how long it is, the master returns. And when he returns, there is an accounting for how the people have used the opportunity that has been set before them. Verse 19. After a long time, the master of those servants returned and settled accounts with them. So he settles accounts. And we need to pause here and recognize an important distinction. The servants in the story, they're not being rewarded with salvation for what they have done. You know, being put right with God, being allowed to enter the kingdom of heaven, being part of God's eternal kingdom, that is not connected to what we do. It's totally connected to what Jesus has done for us. This is the grace of God given freely as a gift to those who believe in Christ. The general public may have an idea that good people go to heaven, but you will not find such a thought in the Bible. On the contrary, we cannot earn our salvation. We certainly don't deserve it. And yet, the Bible does speak about a judgment day for believers as well. Not judging us on our salvation, this is nothing to be afraid of, but it will be a day of assessment when he will want to know what we have done with the opportunities that were given to us. And many times in the New Testament this comes up. I'll just give you one example in 2 Corinthians chapter 5 and verse 10. We must all appear before the judgment seat of Christ so that each of us may receive what is due us for the things done in the body, whether good or bad. And I'll give you a few other references if you're taking notes. 2 Timothy 4 verses 7 and 8. Galatians 6 verses 9 and 10. 1 Timothy 6 verses 17 to 19. They all speak of the fact that one day we will be assessed with how we used what he gave to us. In other words, we are saved by faith. But what kind of faith is it that saves us? It's the kind of faith that shows itself in action. And so on this day of judgment, all people will be judged on whether they are in their sins or not, but then believers will be assessed separately on what they did with what they were given. Every one of us will stand before him, and he will be most interested to see what we did with the opportunities that we had while we were on earth. Now, there are really three parts to this assessment, as you see it in the parable. First of all, there is the commendation. The commendation, verse 20. The man who'd received five talents brought the other five. Master, he said, you've entrusted me with five. See, I've gained five more. And then listen to these words of commendation, verse 21. His master replied, well done, good and faithful servant. And again in verse 23 to the second servant, well done, good and faithful servant. You imagine turning up at the gates of heaven to hear these words spoken to you. Words which will echo down all eternity. Well done, good and faithful servant. You did what I asked you to do. It always takes me back a little bit to my final exams at high school. 3 months before sitting my final exams, my dad had a huge stroke, and he was in hospital for 5 weeks and initially couldn't talk or walk. And I was very conscious as I took the exams that he would feel very responsible, would have felt very responsible if I'd done badly. And I remember the day when the results came through by post in those days, all by post, and the envelope arrived. And rather to my surprise, I'd done a bit better than I thought might have been the case. And I passed the piece of paper on to him, and I just saw a tear roll down his cheek. And his speech was just returning, and he whispered, well done, well done. Now, we don't have to get too sentimental, that was just exams. But on this day, looking forward, how amazing it'll be when the master of everything gives the commendation, well done, my good and faithful servant. He longs to bless his people, and here is an opportunity for him to do so. Now notice then the reason. You get the commendation, you get the reason. Verse 21. You have been faithful with a few things. And again in verse 23. You have been faithful with a few things. Now I think this is very important for us. There are many Christians who think, if only I was a different type of Christian, then I would do more. You know, if I had Billy Graham's gifts at speaking, I'd be Billy Graham. If I had more money in the bank, I'd be more generous than what I am. If I had more opportunity in life, I was a bit less busy, I would do what I could do. But here we see they have been faithful with the few things they have been given. In other words, they have been faithful with what they had. You probably helped me tell this story before, but I love it so much. I'll tell it again. The story of the two little Cockney boys who were protesting their lifelong devotion to each other. And one says to the other, hey, Bobby, he said, if you had £1 million, would you give me half? He said, of course I would. What about if you had £1,000? He says, you know that I would. He says, what about if you had 1,000 marbles, would you give me half? He said, you know I would. He said, what about if you had two marbles? Would you give me up? He said, that's not fair. You know, I've got two marbles. And you see, the point is that God wants our two marbles. He's not interested in our hypothetical acts of devotion if we were different people at a different time in a different life. He's interested in us. He's interested in you, with the person you are, in the person, the situation you are in life, not what you'd be like if you're in a different situation in life. And I think this gives great dignity and great responsibility to us. We need to be faithful in the small things. He's not expecting any one of us to go out and sort of change the whole world. The question is, are we being faithful with what he has given us? The choices we make, with the opportunities we do have, Sunday by Sunday, week by week, that's what he'll be interested in. Whether we showed any appetite to grow as Christians. Did we put our back into the Christian life? It doesn't happen by accident. Those who want to grow more will grow more. Whether we made decisions that showed God's kingdom was more important than our kingdom. And I think this should give us great confidence, because often little decisions don't seem much. Whether I'm prepared to commit to meeting with other Christians on a Sunday doesn't seem much. Whether I'm committed to the spiritual and practical welfare of Christian brothers and sisters might not seem a lot. Whether I take joy in giving financially, whether little or large, to gospel work. Whether in a thousand ways we're able to overlook an insult, take pleasure in someone else's success, show an act of mercy, have time for other people, be kind to those around us, those closest to us, or whether we're harsh with our own children, those sort of things. The point is that most of our lives are made up of small things, not big things. And the question is, are we serving the Lord with those small things? That's the reason these guys have been faithful in the small things. And then there's the reward. And the reward comes in verse 21. I will put you in charge of many things. Come and share in your master's happiness. Jesus doesn't elaborate here on what the many things are, and maybe because the exact substance of them doesn't really matter anyway. In other places, he spoke about laying up treasure in heaven, but he never says what that heavenly treasure will be. What he is clear about is that it is possible to live our lives here and now in such a way that one day that will rebound on us in our favor. You can bust a gut serving Christ and know that one day you'll be rewarded for doing so. And I think we're very reticent to think in this way, as if it somehow contradicts the doctrine of grace or something. But Jesus himself was quite unashamed to use self-interest as a motivator. And there's all the difference in the world between self-interest and selfishness. Self-interest is where you do what is best for yourself without disadvantaging anyone else. Selfishness is where you put yourself ahead of other people. Self-interest is why you don't walk into the road without looking both ways first. There's nothing wrong with that. It's common sense. You are, let's say, causing an advantage to yourself by doing so. Selfishness is where you put yourself at other people's expense. Now, Jesus himself many times uses this as a motivator. And we need to know that this reward is absolutely true. It's absolutely true. And therefore, when you make sacrifices in the Christian life, one of the reasons for doing it is because you will be rewarded in the end. And we need to know that because Jesus knows we need to know it. Because living the Christian life requires sacrifices. You cannot live the Christian life without sacrifices. Every time you say yes to something, you have to say no to other things. In choosing to say, I'm going to come to church on Sunday. In fact, this is what we do as a family. In fact, this is what we're always going to do as a family. You're immediately writing off other options over here. There are sacrifices to be made. Reading a Bible, talk about Bible reading plan and saying prayers, it requires foregoing something else. I mean, maybe silly things, maybe looking at the internet or other things, but you've got to down tools there to pick up tools over here. Using time to serve in an area of church life, in the end, we cannot have it both ways. A choice has to be made, and we need to know that those who choose to follow Christ will be rewarded. Okay, let's wrap up with this third point. Because then in the last part of the parable, so far so good, but now we see that the master punished his unproductive servant for his laziness. The first two servants get rewarded, but the third servant suffers a very different kind of fate. And that comes in verse 24. Then the man who'd received the one talent came. He said, "Master, I knew that you are a hard man, harvesting where you've not sown and gathering where you've not scattered seed. So I was afraid and went out and hid your talent in the ground. See, here is what belongs to you." Now the root problem here, the root problem is his view of his master. He sees the master as being harsh and unfair. In truth, the earlier part of the parable shows the master to be anything but harsh and unfair. He's generous. I mean, he shares all his financial affairs with the servants, gives them the responsibility, and wants to reward them at the end. He's not a hard taskmaster. He's generous. In fact, I think when you read it, the first two servants, I'm not sure they even expect a reward. And there is this kind of embarrassing generosity that the master shows when they give an account. He's abundantly generous, who himself is looking forward to rewarding those who faithfully serve him. But that's not how this last servant sees it at all. He sees the owner as being unreasonable, demanding what he has no right to demand. He resents the owner's right to ask for an accounting. And so instead of doing something with what he'd been given, he does nothing. He says, "I was afraid." And so he just goes and digs a hole in the ground and puts the money in the hole. In other words, this person was guilty not for what he did wrong. He was guilty for doing nothing at all. His was a sin of omission. He knew what he needed to do. He had what he needed to have. And he did nothing with it. And that lack of productivity in the Christian life stems from a wrong view of the master. This third type of servant is akin to the person who sees Jesus Christ as basically unfair. They don't see him as loving and generous. They certainly have no sense of the privilege they have with his precious responsibility entrusted to them. Instead, they bellyache about how unfair the whole process is, and so they don't have anything to show for their lives before God. Their life is a story of wasted opportunity. And the master, let it be noted, is singularly unimpressed with it. Verse 26, he says, "You wicked, lazy servant, so you knew that I harvest where I've not sown and gather where I've not scattered seed? Well, then you should have put my money on deposit with the bankers so that when I returned, I would have received it back with interest." He says such passivity fails on its own warped logic. If you do think the master is harsh, I mean, he isn't, but if you do, the common sense thing to do would be to actually put some effort in. I mean, that would be the logical thing to do. Anything would have been better than putting the money in the ground. In fact, Jesus says giving it to the bankers would have been better. And we know better than anyone in those days that giving it to the bankers these days, it's the last place you put your money if you're hoping for a return on it. But Jesus says that would be better than sticking it in the ground. And so the conclusion is deliberately frightening from Jesus, because he is giving a warning here. Verse 28, "Take the talent from him and give it to the one who has 10 talents. For everyone who has will be given more, and he will have an abundance. Whoever does not have, even what he has will be taken from him." There will be a division. Those who have showed themselves to be faithful will be entrusted with more. Those who have not will be stripped of what they have. And then we'll have all eternity in hell to reflect on the wisdom of their life. Verse 30. "And throw that worthless servant outside into the darkness, where there will be weeping and gnashing of teeth." For all the words that may have come out of this third servant's mouth, you know, "Oh, good sermon, Vicar, loved it today," in the end, his faith was a dead faith. There was simply no evidence for it, because it is our lives that reveal what we believe, not what we say. It's what we do that shows what we actually believe. When Jesus returns, he won't need to give a theology test to see whether we knew the right answers. our lives will tell him everything we know. Exhibit A. And he will look through our lives. This is a repeated theme in the New Testament. You remember when Jesus wrote the letter to the church in Laodicea and complained about them that they were neither hot nor cold, but lukewarm. And he said, you make me want to vomit. You make me sick at the way you do nothing with your faith. And so the question for us is, how will it be when we stand before Christ? I'm not wanting this morning to unduly apply this sort of across the board as if we're all in terrible danger here. But nonetheless, it is a very sobering question because some of us may be. Now, I can give you examples, great and small, of people who work tirelessly in the name of the Lord. I can remind you of famous Christians in the past who you will know as well. I can speak of people who, in the present day, give themselves and give examples of many, many ways, and many ways of people within this fellowship, this church, who give themselves in service of the Lord. But there's a sense in which all of that is irrelevant, or at least on this day of assessment, all of that will be irrelevant, because the only person who will matter to you and me on that day is you and me. I mean, it'll be us standing before the Lord. And all excuses will fall away. To say, oh, I'm sorry, Jesus, I was just so busy during my life, will not cut the mustard. Because busyness is a set of choices. And choices reveal a heart. And it's the heart that is the real issue here. There'll be nowhere for people like that to hide on this day. There'll be no title at work they can hide behind. There'll be no busy calendar to hide behind. What will be revealed will be their hearts, which showed themselves in a set of choices. And so I simply leave you with this parable this morning and ask, what are you doing as the person you are, with the abilities you have, in the circumstances in which you find yourself, to serve the Master? That's the question we'll need to answer on that day, and the question he'll be interested in looking at. Bear in mind, he wants to reward. He wants to reward. This is his heart. He doesn't want a curse. He wants to bless. And it's up to us to give the opportunity for that to happen.